Okay, Rabbi, Boker Tov. Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Eretz HaKodesh, is daf Nun Aleph, which is, of course, the word for please. And please, let us have a wonderful time learning together. And we're at the Halakha Mishnah, Lo Katav La Ketuvah. So continuing on, yesterday we finished a lot of issues in terms of collection, but we have not yet at all finished the list of various clauses that are in the ketuvah. So far we have a pretty simple idea of the issues of the ketuvah. We know that the ketuvah involves a collection of what we call the ikar ketuvah, which is our basic ketuvah, me'ah, mataim, depending on the betulah, the bu'ulah. And we know that we also have three clauses that we've discussed. One is the clause that covers benin dichrin. That is, remember, all male children that you give me out of this marriage will retain the rights to your property, and those rights will not be watered down by any other children that I have from any other women, which means that my heirs of your property, all the things that you brought into this wedding, those things will go only to your family. That's an amazing takana, which allows families to invest in the future of their children without fear of losing their money in a vast pile of Yerusha, of which their children will only have a small share. We also learned the tnayim that are involved in the benin dichrin, and that is that they can only apply. These were all musagim that I've asked you to please try to remember the words for this thing. So we have the benin dichrin, and we also know that they only go into effect if there is a Yerusha d'oraita that is still in effect. So you would need to have $1, a motar dinar that is going to be split evenly between all of the heirs. That way, at least we haven't canceled the Yerusha d'oraita, and that's a very important yesod for us. Then we had the other issue, which was Benot Nukban. The Benot Nukban was, we darshaned yesterday, similar to the Benin Dichrin, in certain ways, in terms of what you could collect from, and that was a commitment to take care of any girls that are your children. They will be taken care of by the estate in the event of my death. They will be supported until such time as they need to get married or until they're grown up. Those were the two basic things that have to do with her children. Then, of course, we had the tanai about herself as a widow, that kol yemei meger amanutech, as long as you will be a widow in my Rishus, meaning you haven't married anybody else, and you haven't been tovat your ketuvahs, we'll see, to go out on your own, then you will be supported by my estate. Then we had some issues that we spoke about in terms of the collection, whether these things could be collected from metaltalim, or whether they could be collected only from karkaot, and what the motar dinar is measured by. Is it measured by metaltalim, or is it measured also only in karkaot? And we spoke yesterday, the last thing that we spoke about was the takanat geonim, and the takanat geonim changed the entire picture. This was sometime in the 14th century, the 13th century, or earlier. It's machlokes in when it took place, but in any event, it is now all over Klal Yisrael, accepted, and it's part of the actual words that we now put in the ketuvah. And all of you will remember those words. Vafilu miglima dal katvoy. You can collect this ketuvah from the shirt off my back, which is about as clear as you could say that it is not limited to karkaot. So that takana became embedded. And as we mentioned yesterday, there's a question of how far does it go? Obviously, on the main ketuvah, that's the whole point. But how much would it cover? Would it cover motar dinar? Would it allow her even to go after a matna shchiv meira? These were issues that have come up in Meshach HaDoros and were paskin in various ways in different locations. Today we want to talk about some of the more arcane, we could call them, Tnaei HaKtuva. And we also want to talk about the binding nature of a Ktuva in the event that it was never given to her. It was never written. So let's begin our Mishnah today on Dav Nun Aleph, which begins with the case where he didn't write a Ktuva. So what if Lo Katav La Ktuva, says the Mishnah? The Chosin never wrote the Ktuva at all. Makes absolutely no difference. A betula is gova mataim, the amona is gova mona, and all of this is because a ktuva is not just a contract. A ktuva, as we've mentioned many times, and this is a beautiful introduction to the continuation, which begins discussing the hidden clauses of a ktuva that nobody ever sees. Unless they're a lawyer getting married, they want to see the whole ktuva. But lemaisa, the ktuva is held in bezdin, so to speak, by definition. And it will include other things. Therefore, we introduce this by saying you should know that the ktuva, even if it's not given, is still binding. And it is a tnai beit din. It's defined in the court. It doesn't have anything to do with whether you personally write a ktuva or not. It's going to be chayev. Now, the question over here is how to understand the clause over here in the Mishnah about he didn't give her a ktuva. What we're assuming right now is that they made a deal and that he said, listen, you know, I don't want to be bound by a ktuva. We sort of have an open marriage. We understand that, you know, things may not work out. And this is it's a prenup agreement that I don't have to pay you a ktuva. What we understand now is that even if she was mochelet, she can't be mochelet. And that the ktuva is binding as part of the nature and definition of what the kedushin and nisuin mean. And therefore, it won't make any difference. I'm going to see whether that's a correct assumption in the Mishnah. How about if he pulls a little bit of a shtick like this? Remember that ein ona'a b'karka'ot. You can't cheat somebody when it comes to real estate because there is no set value to real estate. So if somebody's got a view of the way George Soros decides that this area is going to be a great place for developing a retail mall. Now everybody says he's out of his mind. Nobody lives within 30 miles of this place. Well, it doesn't matter because he's got either some inside information or he's got a good sense for where development is going to be going. So he gives an offer to somebody for three times the amount that the property is worth, right? And then afterwards, can he have a taina that I overpaid? And this is, no. There's no such thing as being cheated when it comes to karkaot. So you would think that in the event that a chosen tells his bride, you know what? I'm setting aside this field for your collection of the ksuva. This is it. This is your ksuva. So now, even if that field would, let's say that field is worth only half of the ksuva. And he says, I'm evaluating this as being worth the full 200. And this is yours. So you would think, since eino na'abakarkaot, so this is fine, because I'm basically giving you something that we've agreed upon is valued at 200. Now, this is a nice chop. So there, even though her name isn't George, nonetheless, you would think that that would be okay. But it isn't. The halacha over there is also that if he was katavla sadeh shove mona tachat matayim zuz, so let's say he did that, and he was careful not to write in the ktuva, the original nusach, which is before the takana of collecting from metaltalim, which was kol nechasim de'itli achraim lektuvatech, every property that I own is responsible for your ktuva, meaning that it backs up your ktuva and that you can go and collect your ktuva. So you say, okay, the combination is unbeatable. He gave her a ktuva. I mean, it's their own evaluation, but it's a valid evaluation. Plus, she can't come and demand payment for anything else because he left out that clause from the ktuva. And he just gave her a ktuva without the statement that it can be collectible. The din is anyway, he's going to have to pay the full 200. She can sue him for the full 200. And she can even go after property. Now, when we say, and again, this is an assumption, so we have to see whether we're correct in this assumption. But the assumption that we're making about the Mishnah is that she gets the full rights of pursuing property. What full rights of pursuing property implies is that even if someone bought this property before her ketuvah was due, either before he died or before he divorced her, that she can go after that property and take it out of the hands of lekuchot. Now, that is called the property which is mishu'ubad. Gavi, the nechasim mishu'ubadim versus nechasim b'nei chorin. So what we're talking about over here, we think, is full access to property, even property that was sold or has other liens on it, as long as her lien came first. Now, let's get on to some of the conditions that are in a ketuvah that people don't even realize. One of them, which we've talked about many times, this is the first time we're finally getting to discuss it in the Mishnah, is insurance against kidnapping. So that he provides whatever it's going to cost to pay a ransom is going to come out of his money. And he didn't write this. Lo katavle, didn't actually write in the ketuvah. I don't think you know anybody who has a ketuvah that includes this, because everybody is relying on the Tanai Bezdin. Lo katavla, im tishtabai afrikinach viotvinach li leintu. So this kind of thing goes into a very serious issue in Mexico, or sometimes in South Africa, and some places where people get kidnapped for ransom. So if he doesn't write that, quote, in the event that you are kidnapped, I'm going to ransom you, and I'm going to bring you back to the home as a wife. I mean, I'm not going to reject you because of the fact that you were raped maybe when you were kidnapped. That's all part of the deal. Now, that doesn't mean, this is the way the Rambam understands. He says he has to take her, if he wants to actually divorce her afterwards because he's uncomfortable with the fact that she was raped, that's a different issue. This is not a promise to keep you as my wife forever, but it means that I will not ipso facto reject you because of the fact that you were kidnapped. I'm going to ransom you. I'm going to bring you back home. That's what I'm going to do. Now, of course, in the event that she is a married to a Kohen, we got a problem because he can't possibly write that because he cannot take her back as a wife in the event that she was raped. And therefore, what he does is bekohenet, in the case of a Kohen who's married to a woman, the language of the ketuvah is slightly different. He doesn't say, otfinach li leintu, I'll take you back as a wife. But what he says is, ahadrinach lebedinatech, I will bring you back to your life and to your life standards and so on. I won't be able, unfortunately, to be your husband. So nonetheless, he is chayav. Why? This is a binding condition of the ketuvah as it's Tanai Beit Din, and it doesn't matter whether it was written or it wasn't written. That's the fact of a ketuvah. And what happens if she's captured? Then nishbet chayav lifdota. Now suppose he says, look, I understand that I'm responsible, okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm divorcing her right now. Here's the divorce. Here's the ketuvah. She's got her money from the ketuvah. Let her pay her ransom. He can't do that, obviously. Im amar haregi tau ketuvata, let her go tifteh atzma, eino reshai. That's the meaning of insurance. Because what the insurance means is that the moment that that kidnapping kicks in, Baruch Avram, that is the moment that he's chayev to pay the full amount. And because of that, he can't say that, well, now I'll get out of it. Thank you very much. If you had divorced her before the kidnapping, that would have been a lovely solution for you, but you're not a prophet and you didn't. Now you're already chayev to pay the kidnapping. That's like an insurance company canceling your policy after the accident. It's ridiculous. So that's clear, and that we're making it clear that it functions as an insurance policy. The next issue would be medical insurance. So now, does the ketuvah include medical insurance? It does. And lakta chayav rapota. If she becomes ill, he has a chiyav to make sure that she is, her medical bills are paid. But where does that come from? That is not a separate clause. That is built into the concept of being mifarnes and mezin. Va'ana afarnes va'ezin otach. Now, obviously, mezin is what is necessary for the survival of her body, and this is included. So it's part, therefore, of the giving over mizonot. But therefore, this is how Rashi understands it, and most of the Rishonim understand it. But Tosfos has a complicated explanation, which is not lefi the pshat, namely that there's a difference in what the reason is for the, remember, we always have a quid pro quo. So in other words, he's going to get her income in exchange for providing the mizonos, let's say, right? So then that means that, according to Tosfos, the mizonos is, that's a constant quid pro quo. Masha Einkein, over here, we're talking about an insurance policy that is being given because of the fact that there was this, all of this nirse malug, and that was what he kept getting. And he got that in advance. That's how Tosfos understands it. Since he got it in advance, so the insurance policy was paid, so he's got to pay out. Rashi explains that the difference between the provision of ransom as an insurance policy and the provision of medicine as an insurance policy is very straightforward. If the medicine is a payment for the actual costs at the time, you can't pay the medical expenses in advance. They aren't due yet. So they are no different than food. It's like saying, okay, if I divorce her, it's too late. I was already chayev in her food. What do you mean? I was chayev in her food until the divorce. So I'll pay all of the bills until the divorce. Now I'm saying I'm divorcing her. Let her pay her own bills. You could do that with food. So why shouldn't you be able to do it with medicine? Therefore, it's not the same as an insurance policy where there's a payout, you see? The payout is at one time. The ransom is due, you pay it out. But you can't say that about medical costs. The medical costs become due as they are incurred. So therefore, if he's no longer a husband at the time that they're incurred, she can't force him to pay out because I got sick while I was your wife. It's whatever bills were due while I was your wife. That makes tremendous amount of sense. And therefore, in this case, Amar Haregita Uktuvata, listen, I'm paying out. Here's the ksuva, here's the get. Now, I don't know what her expenses are going to be. Let her pay for her own medical costs, terapia tatsma. So there he can pater himself. Now, just you should know, by the way, there's a fascinating sifri, which is brought by some of the Rishonim, Halacha Lemaisa, which is that over there, just like by the story of where the Torah gives all of the dinim of marriage and protection of women and so on, all of that is in the context of, believe it or not, the case of the Ephastoa. That's how the whole parsha begins, with the Ki Teitzei LaMilchama, and we learn over there these dinim that we've been talking about, they all appear there in Ki Teitzei. Even the institution of marriage appears in Ki Teitzei. So that means that minimally, you're chayev for a wife, which would be chayev for your fastor, right? So therefore, the Sifrei, which says that when it says that if you decide that you're not taking that yefastor, then you can send her linafsha. But linafsha means that she's got to be fully restored. If she was ill and was nafla lemishkav under your rishus, you can't just throw her out of the house. That's ridiculous. Part of your responsibility for having taken her in the first place is she goes out in at least the same state that she came in. So you have to first cure her. So that is still true, according to some Rishonim. And as the Sifri speaks out, this is true even for a Ben Noach, a Bat Akum, Kol Shekein for a Bat Yisrael, HaKadosha, and so on and so forth. So that is not what we're talking about over here, where she's in the hospital, she's sick, and you're going to come in one day and throw a get at her and put her ksuv in her bank account. That is not what we're talking about, according to those Rishonim. Okay. In any event, this is the Mishnah is just talking about the issue of the actual medical expenses. It's not talking about specific cases. Now, assuming that we were right about the Mishnah and that whatever happens, she, even if she was mochelet, that's what we're assuming, she agreed to him. Okay, fine, let's do without a ksuva. Nonetheless, the ksuva is due. So who is that going according to? Let's take a look at the ratio. Money, Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir said that kol hapochet lebetulah mimataim, anybody who gives less in his ksuva than 200 zuz for a betulah or la'amona mona, then hare zo bi'ilat znut. It means that his kedushin and any intercourse that he has with her is no different than prostitution, which means that the rabbanon answered it. And therefore, you cannot make an agreement to have a prostitution. What kind of agreement is that? That's not part of Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, obviously, and therefore there is no way to get out of it. We're not talking about a financial obligation. We're talking about a Besdin imposed definition of marriage. So that's what it seems to be assuming in the Mishnah. I don't care if the woman agreed that I'm perfectly happy just shacking up with you and we'll call it a marriage because I got a beautiful ring. That is considered to be just plain promiscuity. Fine. Because if you hold of Rabbi Meir's Bar Plukta, Rabbi Meir was always the argument with Rabbi Meir, and the Chachomim are always Rabbi Yehuda. If it's Rabbi Yehuda and Chachomim, it's a reference to Rabbi Meir. So now, according to Rabbi Yehuda, whoa, he holds, so Omar, Ratza Kotev Lebetulah Shtar Shalmataim. Look, what you could always do in order to avoid any of these problems, you write a standard ketuvah to a betulah, and she can write you a receipt. I already received the ketuvah. I received 100. Thank you very much. And the balance of my ketuvah is 100. So there you were mekayim the halacha of writing a ketuvah matayim, and it's not going to cost you more than a mana. If you want to lower the almana, give the almana a mana, and she can write out that the balance is 50, and I already received 50. So since over here the Mishnah says no matter what, she's still going to get her 200, it's mashma that even if she agreed, not like Rabbi Yehuda, even if she agreed, let's do without, that it doesn't help. He's still going to get the full matayim. If that's the case, it's got to be Rabbi Meir. Okay, now let's take a look at the Seifa. The Seifa says that katavla, yeah, see, look at the difference. I mean, that this is something that is ma'oring you to want to drink. Now, when you sit there with some lousy cup, you can't see what's in it. You think maybe it's even just some kind of a instant coffee or something. And here we're talking about reality. L'chaim. Okay, so now the problem is that the Seifa, which says, suppose you didn't commit yourself for a collection from all of your property. You're still chayev. Why? Shuhu tnai beit din. Now, the problem is that if you write a shtar and you leave out the property insurance from the shtar, that's called achrayut. You leave out the achrayut. The question is, Gavi, achrayut to'ut sofer or not? This is a machlokes. Achrayut to'ut sofer means that if a shtar is missing those lines, that all of my nechasim are achroy to you and you have a lien against them in the event anyone should come and be successful in legally taking away this field from you through showing that it was stolen by me or that there were pre-existing liens or whatever, I'm responsible and everything that I own is responsible. In that case, the buyer can go after the seller and can collect even from fields that have been sold subsequent to the purchase of his own field because he had a pre-existing lien on all of the person's property, right? Now, suppose somebody leaves that out of a shtar. Can he still, the buyer still go ahead and collect, or can the seller say, hey, wait a minute, man, let's read that contract. That contract doesn't say one word about property insurance. Oh, heck, I didn't read it through. What? I thought every contract contains a problem. Well, you know, next time get yourself a better lawyer. Tough on you. So that's a question. Is leaving out the din of achrayut called a clerical error? A clerical error is called a ta'ut sofer. If we view it as a clerical error, so then it's as if it said that, because it's the definition of a contract. In the same way that we're claiming that a ketuvah, we said, includes those words, whether you wrote them or you didn't write them, correct? But that's only true according to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda is the one who says that in the event that it doesn't write that, it makes no difference. Achrayut ta'ut sofer hu. Because Rabbi Meir Dafka holds that achrayut is not a ta'ut sofer. If it's left out, then it's not applicable. And I'll show you a very simple difference that this is going to make so that you can tell whether you're talking about Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Yehuda. Imagine a case like this. You pick up a wallet. You open up that wallet. Somebody dropped the wallet. You open up the wallet, and there is a contract in there that says that so-and-so owes so-and-so $1 million, right? Now, can you give it back to the person whose name is on it? No. You don't know whether it was paid or it wasn't paid. You don't know whether the guy had returned the contract to the borrower already. And now if you give it back to the lender, he's going to recollect another $1 million. Maybe you should have given it to the borrower. On the other hand, if you gave it to the borrower, maybe you're pottering him from paying out $1 million and he can show that he had already the shtar returned from the lender. So you're not allowed to give it back. How about if the borrower says, no, of course, give it back. I never paid a penny. I owe him $1 million. Of course, pay it. Give him back his contract. Can you give it back? Well, you'll think, why not? Of course, give it back. The guy's ready to admit. Now, wait a minute. Aha. Suppose these two guys are very sneaky manipulators. So what they do is they drop the contract after the contract's been paid up, right? Or before the contract's been paid up, whatever the deal is. So now they drop the contract and they made a deal between them. I'm going to say that I never paid. So you take the contract and you come to me and you say, where's my money? And I assure you, I don't have any money. Of course, I don't have any money. I already gave it all to you. But okay. But I don't have any money. So you say, all right, well, did you own any fields? And I say, yeah, I did own fields, but I sold them. That was with the fields I sold to pay you. Bah, but nobody knows that. So now let's go after the buyer of the field together and we'll split it. I'll get back the field that I sold in order to pay you back. And you keep half of the money so that you were paid back 1.5 times what it was. And I get my fields back. Nice deal, right? So I will admit that this was never paid, even though it was. What do you think of that? So therefore, we need to take that into consideration. Now, suppose the contract that you found did not have the fateful words, kol nechasai achroin ve'arvoin, I do not guarantee this property. So if they don't have that written in it, so then, okay, so then you can give it back, because then you can't go after the property at all. So what can you possibly lose, right? But that's only true according to Rabbi Meir. But according to Rabbi Yehuda, even if it didn't say it, you can't return it, because Beis Din is anyway going to be able to go after the property because achrayuto utsofer, which is Rabbi Yehuda. So now our Mishnah is claiming that even if you left out the fateful words from Ksuv, and it doesn't say kol nechasai achrayin varvain, and so on, it doesn't matter. You could still go, So who's that going according to? That's going according to Rabbi Yehuda, who says you can always go after it, whether it says so or not, because achrayut is a ta'ut sofer. Now make up your mind about this Mishnah. First part of the Mishnah is going according to Rabbi Meir, that you can never reduce the payment of a ksuva, which is against Rabbi Yehuda, who says you can. And the second part is saying it's actually a ta'ut sofer, and Beis Din will always go after the property that was sold after your lien was in effect. And that's going like Rabbi Yehuda. Reisha, Rabbi Meir, v'sefer, Rabbi Yehuda. Now, I know what you're going to try to say. You're going to try to say is that maybe the whole Mishnah is going according to Rabbi Meir, but I guarantee you this is what you were thinking. But a ksuva is different. And shiny leila Rabbi Meir ben ktuva l'shtari, that when we have, since we have standards of ksuva that are defined in Beis Din, so therefore, even if you issued a ksuva that is missing that, of course, a ksuva is different. A ksuva is defined. And we're only talking about a ksuva. What does that have to do with finding a shtar on the street? That's a completely different question. But Rabbi Meir would agree to Rabbi Yehuda in the place where a ksuva was written without achrayas nechasim. You can't just leave out achrayas nechasim from a ksuva, you idiot. It's defined in Beis Din as including achrayas nechasim. That's your first reaction. And then there's no problem in the Mishnah whatsoever. Why does this have anything to do with the machlokas of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda about whether it's considered to be a ta'ut sofer? That's what you'll try to say to me, and I'm going to prove to you that you would be wrong, because mishainile, is there really, according to Rabbi Meir, any difference between a ksuva or anything else? And what about the braita? The braita says, chamishagovin min hamechurarim. There are five cases where you can collect, but you cannot go after property that was sold. Those are called mishu'ubadim. You can only go after mechurarim. Go after free and clear property that has no lien against it or wasn't sold to anybody else. And what are those five cases? Well, we have peirot and shevach peirot. So peirot and shevach peirot consist of the following case. Somebody buys a field. Reuven buys a field from Shimon. And he invests a lot of money in that field, puts in watering systems, and he puts in a lot of fertilizers, and he has the whole thing planted. He creates this beautiful orchard and so on. 3 years later, he is approached by someone who claims that the field was stolen by Reuven, sold to him, Shimon, and now I, Levi, want my field back. And he proves it in court, and the court comes and throws him out of the field. And the guy is saying, but I've invested $3 million in this field. Well, what, you can't just throw me out of the field. Sir, this is not your field. Bye-bye. And we throw him out of the field. So now he is stuck with trying to recover his money from the seller. The seller sold him a field that he never owned. This happens all the time, as you know. You know, I mean, so I didn't know that you didn't own the Brooklyn Bridge. Okay. So in this case, can he get back the money that he invested? Of course he can. Problem is that he can only collect the money that he invested and the fruits that are on the trees that he grew and so on and so forth, which were all taken away by the court when he was thrown out. He can collect them, but he cannot collect them from buyers of fields that bought the fields even after the time that you would think he is already has a lien. Why is that? Because remember that the concept of protection, buyer protection, is a takona of the Rabbanan, and it's based on the opening up of markets and the preservation of real estate exchanges, right? If people, when they buy things, have absolutely no idea of what they're getting into, they have no way of protecting themselves. So because of that, we provide the understanding in registering liens. How do we register liens? We register them by creating a contract, which then has a call, which is the equivalent of the modern term of registration. Now, in the event that what we're talking about is a lien that can be activated for any amount of money, and there is absolutely no way to know what it is that might be coming at you, then we cannot provide any kind of insurance for that. So if a guy is going to go ahead and he's going to buy a field and he's going to say, okay, look, I happen to know that there are liens outstanding against this field. How do I know? I know from the contracts that I've seen. And if there aren't any other contracts, nobody's talking about any other contracts, then there aren't any other liens. So I can protect myself. How? Because I examine what this person owns, and I see he's got plenty of money. He's got plenty of fields. If he sells out any of these other fields, I'm protected anyway because I can take them away from the buyer. So fine. So now I feel confident enough to engage in a real estate transaction. But supposing it's an open-ended lien, I have no way of knowing whether I'll ever be able to recoup my money. So in this case, I know what the guy paid for the field. He paid $1 million. I know that this guy who sold the field has another field currently, and it's worth $1 million. So if anything goes wrong and I want to buy it, I can always come back and collect from his $1 million. Now, if the lien includes the $1 million plus whatever the buyer had invested, I might get hit for the bill for $10 million. I don't know what he invested. What, do you think I'm crazy? I'm going to buy a field where I can get hit with something that I'll never be able to recover? No way. Therefore, of course, we cannot provide open-ended liens because there would be no way for anybody to protect themselves against an open-ended lien. Clear? Beautiful. So sophisticated. It's so wonderful to say all of the possible implications were taken into consideration. It's just a pleasure to be dealing with human beings. What can I tell you? Anyway, so now, in that case, you will not be able to collect from sold property, but you can from mechurarin, from unsold property, obviously. I mean, this guy sold you a field. He's got to take responsibility. So peirot v'shevach peirot. Shevach peirot means basically shevach of the karka in order to produce peirot. And in the event that somebody got married by adding voluntarily a condition that he is going to continue to support the child, son or daughter of the woman that he married, and she has children from her previous marriage, that's open-ended. Again, there's no way for me to, I don't know how long he's going to be paying child support over here because there's no determined amount in advance. So therefore, I'm never going to buy. If Lemaisa, he did make a particular limit, suppose he capped the support at 2 years of support or X amount of dollars of support, and he actually wrote this in a contract, or he made a kinyan, which is the equivalent of written in a contract. He made a kinyan with Adam, and therefore the word gets around. Then I can protect myself. It's up to me if I want to buy or not. But usually this is open-ended. And if it's not kept, then it cannot be collected from things that were sold, even though my lien should come first, technically speaking. We didn't provide you with a lien in these cases. All right? That's the next possibility. You can collect, but you can't collect from anything that was sold. How about a get chov? Get used to the idea that the word get does not mean a divorce. The word get means a contract, and a get chov means a loan contract. So if there is no achrayut written, no achrayut written, you can't collect. So then this means that achrayut is not a ta'ut sofer. And if it wasn't provided you, you can't use it. You can't go in order to be able to collect with it. Okay, so this is Rebbe Meir, right? Now here's the critical words coming up right now. Uktuvat isha she'en ba achrayut, or a ktuva that doesn't have achrayut. Hey, guys, what does this mean? That Rebbe Meir does not make any difference between a loan document or a ktuva. If it has the words, kol nechasai achrayin varvayin, fine. If it doesn't, that's not a mistake. It's not a clerical error. It's not going to provide you with any kind of ability to exercise a lien, okay? So now tell me, who is the man di Omar who said that the achrayut over here is not considered to be a clerical error, and if it's missing, you are missing the right to collect, which is what it says over here in item number 4. That's Rebbe Meir. That means that item number 5 is Rebbe Meir, and he is making no difference at all. It's Rebbe Meir, and it includes Ktuvat Isha in the list of the 5 circumstances that you will not be provided with an ability to collect from property that was sold. Ha ha. So there goes your explanation how everything could work out according to Rebbe Meir. It does not work out according to Rebbe Meir. So now I present you with my question. Tell me how the Mishnah works. It's not Rebbe Meir. It's not Rebbe Yehuda. I'd like a solution. I can give you 2 solutions. I can show you 1 solution like Rebbe Meir, says the Gemara. And if you like, V'boit Ema Rebbe Yehuda, I can give you an explanation according to Rebbe Yehuda too. Let's start from the last one first, okay? Ibait, if you wish, Ema, I will tell you, Rebbe Yehuda. And here's how it would work. There's obviously a difference in the cases that we talked about before in Rebbe Yehuda, where she writes, I was already mekabel my ktuva, which is a perfectly kosher receipt, whether in reality she did receive it or not. Now, over there, she wrote that. That means that she essentially has written down her mechila of the full ksuva, correct? And therefore, that's good. But in our Mishnah, it doesn't say anything about her saying that I'm mochelet. So what you assumed that it's talking about over here, he didn't write her a ksuva because they agreed that she's not going to get a ksuva. But that was wrong. It's talking about that they never discussed it. He just didn't give her a ksuva. So what it's saying is that even though we cannot assume that she was mochelet, that nonetheless, we cannot assume she was mochelet, so what do we assume? She was relying on the Tanai Besdin. She knows every woman gets a ksuva. I don't know. Maybe in this town they don't write the ksuva, whatever. So therefore, of course, over there, the din would be that even Rebbe Yehuda would agree that she could collect every last penny. So the Mishnah, only reason the Mishnah didn't agree with Rebbe Yehuda is because of your own narrative. I mean, there was no reason for you to make that assumption that she had been mochelet. So I don't know what your question was. You don't like that approach? If you like, Ibait, if you want, Ema Rebbe Meir. I'll tell you that it's going according to Rebbe Meir. Because, again, it's your own narrative. What did you say the Mishnah means? That she collects the entire ksuva. She does. Doesn't that mean she collects even from property that was sold? No. Where does it say that? Well, I just assumed. Thank you very much. So you just assumed. Exactly. Big problem in life is just assumed. So therefore, the Mishnah is perfectly good, according to Rabbi Meir, because when it says that she gets the ksuva and he's chayav the ksuva, it never said that she can go after anything other than Meshucharim. That's all. So forget about the toes, sefer, or whatever. It has nothing to do with it. Nobody ever mentioned it. Okay. The next thing that we talk about is the insurance policy for providing ransom. So if he didn't write to her outright the clause that in the event that you will be captured, I shall ransom you and take you back to be my dear wife for the day. And if he didn't write that, so then he's mechuyev anyway. Omar Avu Deshmuel. Now this seems to be something we're about to hear that is totally against the Mishnah. It says over here, if an Eishes Yisrael was ne'ensa, she's a surah labala. What? Note, remember, that the Mishnah said that in the event that she is captured, which includes the fact that she would be raped or we'd be afraid that she was raped, he is going to still ransom her and take her back to be his wife. And then Avod Shmuel says that the halacha is that if she was raped, if she's an Eishes Yisrael, not an Eishes Kohen, obviously, if she's an Eishes Yisrael, she is Asura Levala. Why? Well, because even though we know she was raped, as you know, it's all very nice that she may be shouting at the beginning, but at the end she's making all kinds of moaning sounds, and something has changed. Now, at that point, she is considered to be Beratzon. So therefore, how do we know that there wasn't a Ratzon? Shema Techilata Ba'ones, yes, it's true that she was kidnapped, but there got a point where she was ready to go along. So we always have to worry about that. So Rav asks Avuah Deshmuel, what are you talking about, man? The Mishnah says beferish that the clause in the ketuvah reads that im tishtabai afrakinach votinach liliintu, that if she's not an Eishes Kohen, that this guy is promising to ransom her and to take her back as a wife. Now, how in the world can you possibly claim that he's not allowed to take her back for a wife if that's the whole point? The Kohen, who's not allowed to take her back as a wife, has to write a different thing. He has to write, I'll bring you back to your city, whatever. But, I mean, how can you write something that's usher? Ishtik. So Avuah Deshmuel was pretty shocked. Oi, oi, oi. He's sitting over there with his hand over his mouth, stroking his beard. I mean, you can just see this. Oi, oi. So we talked about that in the pasuk. Kori Rav alei Avuah Deshmuel. So Rav said, you know, that's what Eov points out. Sarim atzru b'milim. Great sarim. How would you say a sarim? I keep forgetting how to say sar v'gadol in English. Huh? Come on, Barnea, how do they translate Sar v'gadol nafal v'yisrael?
It has to be more than an official. It has to be much better than that. It has to be more than just an official.
No, of course. It means, you know, a nobleman, a great minister that I hear, Richie, I heard the sound of King Richard. Tell us.
A minister.
Minister. Nah, come on. What are we talking about, a church here? Oh, I see what you mean, like a prime minister of affairs. Okay, all right, fine. Okay, so anyway, it says that this great official ended up stuck for words. Atzru b'milim. They had nothing to say. V'chaf yasim alafiyem. All they're doing is stroking their beards and they got their hands over their mouths. This is Nebuch. What has happened to Avud Shmuel? A tragedy. There was plenty he could have answered me. What's he sitting over there with his hand over his mouth? Well, I understand. How could he have answered you, Rav? It seems like a fatal kind of question. What are you talking about, says Rav? I just wanted him to explain the obvious difference that any five-year-old knows. The difference is Bishvuya Hikilu. He was talking about a case where we know that she was raped. So he's saying, if we know that she was raped, then we are concerned that part of rape often ends up being a willingness to go along with the experience once he's got me. So in the case where she's a shvuya, we have no idea that she was raped. We're chayshish that she was raped. So over there in Bichlal, we find a lot of dinim that it's a, we're mekel. So we're going to also say, well, she was probably raped, and if she was raped, she probably went along with it. That's not the same as this saying that we have a chashash. Well, I don't understand, says the Gemara. According to Shmuel's father, so when the Torah says beferish, we're going to see that beferish, if a woman was raped, she is muteret to her husband. So where is that ever mutter? I don't, if you're always going to tell me that I'm concerned that a woman goes along with a rape at the end, so then where did the Torah say otherwise? No, that would be a case. Let's say there's witnesses that she's fighting him and screaming the whole time. So over there we see that she did not go along. Baruch Avram. Baruch Avram. I know the schedule is rough. Anyway, so there it would be the only case. But where we have a chashash that maybe things were different, then Enochinami should be a surah. Now this psak of Avuah de Shmuel runs against Rava. This is the famous psak of Rava, that a woman who does change screams to moans is not considered to be anything but a victim. Because putting another human being in a situation in which they are irresistibly drawn into it, what's she supposed to do? You can resist the beginning of a sexual experience, but you can't resist its culmination. And therefore, he put her, this rapist, put her into a position where even if she is going along, she's considered to be an anusa, because she was forced into a situation that she cannot do anything about. And that is called anus. You can be raped by your yetzer hara. And where we know that the norm is that you cannot control that, that's considered to be a rape. So if it was tchilata ba'onis v'sof baratzon, even if she, forget about if she moans, even if she tells the cops who come, let the guy alone, I'm having a wonderful time, don't you dare take him off of me. It makes no difference. And she says, beferish, hanichulo, leave him, leave him. I'll tell you the truth, she says to the cops. If he hadn't raped me, I would have paid him. So much for the taina she was asking for it, right? So over here, she's telling the cops, I'm asking for it. Doesn't make any difference. Once she's already begun with this ones, she's considered to be an anusa. And she is muteret for her husband. My taima, yetzer albasha. The yetzer hara has taken her over. And therefore, she is not considered to be a surah to her husband. That is good for the machlokas. So therefore, even if we know for a fact that she was raped, and even if we know for a fact that she wants to go along with it, makes no difference to us. She is still considered to be an anusa, other than, of course, the situation of a kohen, where even though she is anusa, she is a surah. And in fact, there's a beautiful bright that is medayik from the pasuk, exactly what it is that Rava said. Tanika vasidarava. Vihi lo nitfasa. So remember the whole diuk that we had in the posik of the soita. V'shachav ish ota shichvat zera v'ne'alam me'enei shah v'nistara v'hi nitma'a. Turns out that she had slept with the guy and he lo nitfasa. She had not been forced and raped. Now, why does it say v'hilo nitfasa? It should just say v'lo nitfasa. V'hilo nitfasa means, in this case, regarding this particular woman, the fact that she was lo nitfasa is mechayev her. But yesh lacha acheret she'afa pishalo nitfasa. This is he, but there's her. There's another he. And that other he is the other one, she'afa pishalo nitfasa muteret, where even if she wasn't raped, she still is allowed to be with her husband, ve'ezuzo. That is referring to a woman who initially was raped and then begged to be allowed, the guy should be allowed to continue to rape her. So koshi tchilato ba'ones v'sofa biratzon is considered to be, this is Rav Tzadok who says that he was makabel, that was Zimri's svara. Zimri, who went after this woman, he felt that she was irresistible. So what's he supposed to do? Yetzer al b'shei. Problem is, you can't judge that about yourself. He's got the whole amazing shot in this, that the truth is, this is always true. There are times where people cannot resist, but you don't have a right to make up in your own mind, I can't resist, so therefore I'm an ones, right? I mean, if we could, life would be a lot different. All right. So, in any event, this would be the halacha built on healing it vasa. And that's the meaning of Rava. Now, there's another braita that gives a different explanation of hilo nitvasa. Hilo nitvasa asura ha nitvasa mutera. This is a case where because she was raped, she is muteras. But there's another who, even in the event that she was raped, is asura. Ve'ezozo, this is an eshes kohen. Exactly. There's another remez of the vehi. Rav Yirameh Shmuel Mishum Rabbi Yishmael. V'hi lo nitfasa asura, ha nitfasa muteret. Only this woman is muteret because of the fact that she was raped. But there are other cases where even if she wasn't raped and she went willingly to another guy and committed adultery, she is still muteret to her husband. Where is that? Yesh l'acheret she'afa pi shelo nitfasa muteret ve'ezo zu. That would be a case where kiddushia kiddushia ta'ut, meaning that the husband had originally, let's say, made a condition in the kiddushin. The condition was never carried out, and therefore the marriage is annulled retroactively, which means that when she was so-called committing adultery, she wasn't married. So how can you commit adultery if you're not married? It turned out retroactively he was not her husband. Now she wants to go and get married to him properly without any conditions. Go right ahead. But wait a minute. She was sleeping with another. What do you mean another guy? It wasn't another guy. She wasn't married at that time. So in that case, she can, even though it turns out that it's 5 years later and the guy impregnated her and she's got a child and everything else, makes no difference. The child was born out of wedlock. But what do you mean? They've been living together for years. Yeah, but remember that he promised her that after 3 years, he's going to buy her a house, and he never bought her a house, and now she was never married. Not a bad idea. Okay, so this way, even if she's carrying her child in her backpack, and benamu kaval ktefa, which this guy bought for her, mima enet v'olechet la, she can just walk out on him. Rav Yehuda, you know, married women that were ganvu ganve, they were just these ganovim that captured these women. They are mutarot l'balehem, because if they've been raped, they have no desire to go along with it. Omri le Rabbanu le Rabbi Yehuda, what do you mean? What about the Stockholm syndrome? Look what's going on over there. Do you see them bringing all kinds of food, coffee, hot coffee, and home-baked cookies to these Ganovim? I mean, what do you mean they're being raped? So then, Hakamat Matim Luhud Nahama? Yes, because they're terrified. So because they're terrified, Machmas Yira. So psychologically, they go along with them, and they'll provide them with coffee and so on. But man, they're bringing out ammunition. These guys are shooting at the cops. They're riding on the motorcycles. And who do you think is putting ammunition in their submachine guns? Patty Hearst. So you're going to tell me that she was being dragged into this? Yes, I am. It's Machmas Yira. What's the difference if they're putting ammunition in? It's all Machmas Yira. I'll tell you where you run into a problem with Patty Hearst. When they let her go and she goes running back to them. Now that's a bit of a problem. So there you've got a real Stockholm syndrome where there's no element of Yira that she recognizes anymore. So Vadai Shafkinu Va'azlon Minafshayu. If they're let free and they turn around and go back to dear lover, then of course they're also. Tana Rabbanan, we have other cases. Let's say that the Malchus is going around capturing girls for the king's harem. So Shavuyei Malchut, they have the din of any other Shavui, and they're also considered to have been Anus, and he has to pay whatever it costs to get her out of there. But Genuvei Listut Einan Kishvuyim. If they're captured by these robbers, by just regular cheapo bandits, that's different. They become asurot. Aye, it says the opposite. We'll discuss what the point is. Over here in a bright that says exactly the opposite, that if they're shvuyei malchut, then they're asurot. But if they're shvuyei ganve, then they are mutarot. So what is that going? How to explain the contradiction? Therefore, says the Gemara, look, the whole thing is all contextual. So in the event that the Malchut captures them, Malchut ha-Malchut lo kasha, let's say you're talking about the kind of Melech like Achashverosh, she knows 100% this Achashverosh is going to treat her the way Achashverosh did. You know, he'll take advantage of her, he's certainly not going to marry her. So all she wants is out, and therefore it's all a rape, and there's no chashash that she should be asura lebaala. Masha Einkein, if you have a malchut ben netzer, some of the mefarshim point out that it can't be a coincidence that you have the idea of the Achashverosh as a netzer. Netzer sounds an awful lot like Nebuchadnezzar, right? So a ben netzer. So there's a difference. If you're talking about a malchut ben netzer, again, a lot of different pirushim. This person is an actual person that used to go around, and he was a major mafioso. They were able, it was like one of these Middle Ages, you know, group of bandits that would capture whole towns and cities and set up this guy who was in charge. He would treat himself like a king, and he would set himself up with the whole government. The guy liked the feeling of being a king. Okay, so that's one possibility. There's a lot of approaches. But in any event, what we're talking about over here is a two-bit king. What was that, the little king? Remember they used to have that cute little, I don't know if anybody's old enough to remember, the little king. Okay. So the little king is ben netzer. So she could always dream that if the little king has picked her up, she might become the little queen. So in that case, we're choshesh that indeed she might dream about becoming queen, the little queen. So there she's asura. Masha Enke and the other brisa was not talking about that. Listus Aliz is also not a kasha. Haba ben netzer. So the first brisa was talking about the type of bandit, so to speak, who's a little king. So he rules over the whole town, you know? So again, these are like the old A-team kind of things. Okay. So she thinks in that case, she is hoping to become the queen. So over there she becomes Asura. Mashenken, if it's a regular low-class bandit, all she wants is out. So over there she's Muteret. Wait a minute. I mean, you can't call Ben-Netzer. In one place you call him the little king, and in the other place you call him the big bandit. Understand, which one is he? Is he a bandit or is he a king? First you say, second you say, actually, Asim Karele Melech, and the first Brisa, you called him essentially a Ganav Gnuve. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying the whole thing is relative. The two Brisot are relative, vis-a-vis Achashverosh. So over there, he's the little king, and she may have hopes of being the little queen. If you're going to compare him to Stam gangs that have no real power and they're in and out and hiding out from the cops and so on, so then compared to that, he's a king. He doesn't hide. He's in the open. He took over the whole town. You know, this is a Mexico, a Mexican drug bandit, in which case the whole area worships him as the king. So over there, she may hope to be the little queen. Excellent.